Okay. My goal right now is just to briefly present the sources on the source sheet. This shiur is fundamentally based on a piece from a sefer called Ha'avot V'Shvatim by Rav Avraham Korman. I haven't found that much biographical information on him. He seems to have been born in Poland and was close with the Babov Rebbe. Not sure if his family itself was Babov. And then he made Aliyah. And in Israel, he seems to have been more of a Torah Amada figure, for lack of a better term. And he has a very interesting approach in this piece to the sale of the Bechorah between Esav and Yaakov. So he begins by just presenting three, he really presents more than three, but we'll just look at three of the classic approaches to what exactly was sold. What is this Bechorah that was sold between the two of them? So the first one, Rashi, Bechorascha, Lefisha Avoda Bechoros, Amar Yaakov, Ein Rasha Ze Kadash Yakriv LaKadosh Baruch Hu. So here, it was fundamentally the right to offer up karbanos. Karbanos were offered up by the Bechor, and Yaakov didn't feel it was appropriate that they should be offered up by Esav, so he wanted to buy the merits to that avoda, that he should do it. And Esav seems to be fine with that, because he hears about, in the second Rashi there, he hears about all the punishments, especially the punishment of death, that are associated and come along with not following all the different halachos of bringing a karban, and decides he doesn't want to get mixed in with that. And then when the pasuk says Vayivez Esav, that he insults the Bechorah, that just is the pasuk coming and telling us that he insulted Avodas Hashem, fundamentally. It's an interesting approach. Rav Korman brings up a number of issues that he feels this brings up. So the first, he says, the fact that karbanos are brought by the Bechor is something that comes in response to the Exodus, to Yetzias Mitzrayim. Meaning to say that because of Machat Bechorah, therefore we have the idea of a Bechor being involved with the Avoda. But prior to that, it doesn't seem to exist. We have people in the Torah itself that were not necessarily the Bechor, or there's at the very least no emphasis that they're the Bechor, that bring karbanos. And if anything, historically, that also seems to play out. If anything, there was actually the Bechor themselves being brought as the karban, not that they were bringing the karban. They themselves were the human sacrifice, as it were. And anyway, how exactly do you buy the rights to something? This is just basically a biological reality. You were born first. How do you buy that? The second approach that he brings is basically that Yaakov was out to buy the double inheritance that was awarded to Esav by dint of him being born first. Which he brings from a number of early Mefarshim. You can see it from the Das Ekeinim. Kama Shehi Shaveh, sell me today the Bechorah, whatever it's worth right here now, which isn't a whole lot. Dainu Betovas Hana Davar Muat. Sharim Tamus Bechaya Abba, Lo Tereshenu Veloto Lecha HaBechorah Klum. Right now, this double inheritance that you're set to get upon Yitzchak's death is not really worth that much. It's just potential or prospective benefit, perspective that I could get from it. So what was sold between the two of them? Yaakov was buying the potential rights to inherit, which again, at that point, was not that much. It's just the potential that he's buying. And there, I put a footnote in there that Das Ekeinim uses the term Tovas Hana, which in the cases I've seen usually means something a little different. But I'm grateful to Rabbi Mordechai Torchiner for helping clarify how exactly Das Ekeinim was using it, and you can see that in the footnote there. But Rav Korman's issues with this approach is, if it's speaking about inheritance, how is Yaakov being so brazen as to kind of set out under his own initiative to get his inheritance, or in some way, shape, or form, prior to Yitzchak's death? It seems a little unseemly. Secondly, why would Esav sell his double inheritance for some lentil stew? Granted, he apparently is very hungry, but it still doesn't really add up. And if this is talking about inheritance, what's the reason that Esav insults it? What motive does he have to insult it? Doesn't seem entirely clear. The third approach that we have in the source sheet is that they were basically having a sale of the burial plot in Ma'aret Machpelah, where the Gemara in Sota Yud Gimel Amud Aleph describes that after Yaakov dies, his body is brought up to out of Egypt, and right as the burial procession reaches Ma'aret Machpelah, they're interrupted by Esav, who says, what are you guys doing? This is my grave that you're about to put him into. And so the family members argue, saying, no, you sold the birthright, but you didn't sell, let me restate that. Esav says, listen, this is my grave. And they said, no, you only sold the birthright. The Bechorah, you did not sell a grave. And he argues with them, saying, no, it was a package deal, apparently. And they go back and forth, and the family says, listen, we have the actual document recording the sale, but it's in Egypt. So let's find somebody, whoever can go down there the fastest, and they will get it for us. And before anything can be resolved in that manner, one of the other family members who was deaf, or at the very least hard of hearing, Hushim ben Dan, goes and hits Esav over the head. And according to this Gemara here, the eyes of Esav fell out. And ending the story there, ending the discussion, apparently. And there, Rav Korman says, well, if Yaakov was after the grave plot in Ma'aret Machpelah in exchange for the remainder of Yitzchak's wealth, why would Esav sell him a grave plot with the logic of, listen, I'm going to die anyway, I don't need it? That doesn't make any sense. If he's going to die soon, he needs the grave plot and not all that wealth. Also, it's very interesting that Esav never challenges the fact that, yeah, I stole the Bechor. He seems totally fine with it still. But he does attempt to refute the sale of the grave plot, which Rav Korman takes and feels that maybe there were two different sales being spoken about here. Which, in fact, later on is what he does say. So then, if we look at the actual sale itself, it's in Chafei in Perek 25, starting really with Pasuk Chavtes 29, was describing Yaakov was cooking, and Esav comes in, and he was exhausted. And he asks for the food. And then they Yaakov proposes this sale to him, and Esav agrees. And there are a number of aspects of the story that are bizarre. Why does Yaakov act toward Esav the way that he does in the story? Meaning somebody, just any person, comes from the outdoors, and they're exhausted, and they ask for food. Would your response be, if you sell me something? No, chances are you're going to give them some food. That's basic manners. Especially, it's his brother. It's that aspect is a little strange. Also, the Pasuk in Pasuk Lamed Dalet 34 says that Esav eats, ve'yakam ve'yelech ve'ylach vives, Esav is a bechora. That he ate, then he got up, and he left. And all are after leaving, does the Pasuk say, that he demonstrated his disdain or disrespect for the Bechorah. So why is it only after he leaves Yaakov's presence that that happens, according to the Pasuk? Also, in Pasuk Lamed in 30, where we're told, Esav asks Yaakov for some of the food. Halateni na min ha'adom ha'adom hazeki ayif anuchi. Al ken kara shemo Edom, So there is it for me, some of this red food because I am very tired. Therefore, his name is Edom. What exactly are we being told about his name? Is it saying I'm very tired and therefore we call him Edom? That doesn't make sense. Obviously, it's referring back to the food, but it's a strange separation. And also, if we're dealing with names, why didn't they also mention the name Edom when he's born, where it says, V'yetze arishon admoni, kulo. Kuluka der se'ar. There in Pasuk Chaf Hey in 25. It would have made much more sense to put it there. It's also strange that Esav apparently can't even recognize the food that Yaakov is cooking to call it by its actual name. He just calls it by the color. So he seems to be in a very strange headspace. And he also uses very polite language, which he does not use in other places when he speaks. Again, putting him in a very strange headspace, apparently. So Rav Korman thinks that there's something strange going on, that he thinks it's clear something happened that day that has really made a deep impression on Yaakov and would also explain why Esav seems to be acting so strange and almost incoherent. And so he starts his analysis with this introduction in Source 5. Therefore, it is up to us to reconstruct the events that occurred and the relationship between the two brothers and their family based on information preserved in Agarta, in Midrash, in Gemara, with the background of common custom from that time period. As is known from the Torah itself, Yitzchak married Rivka Bas Pesuel, sister of Lavan Arami. Rivka left her father's home in Paddan Aram and set up her own home in Be'er Sheva. Eventually, she has two sons, Esav and Yaakov. Her brother Lavan also starts a family and has daughters. As was common during this period, and later times as well, parents would arrange marriages for their children, especially daughters, as soon as they were born, or at the very least, soon afterward. This family was no different and arranged for their daughters to marry Rivka's sons. And of course, the daughters are Rachel and Leah. In fact, the Agarta, this is coming from the Gemara, which I put in the bullet point there from Bava Basra, describes that Leah's eyes were weak from crying so much. She would sit at the crossroads and ask, have you heard anything about Esav? I'm destined to marry her. I've been set up with him. And I want to know who he is exactly. And she was hearing terrible things about him. So she was mourning that destined marriage to Esav. So clearly, things were set up. It seems clear from that Gemara that Esav was destined to marry Leah. That's what the families arranged. And Yaakov and Rachel were arranged to be married. And it was just a matter of time until the sisters were old enough. It appears that they were younger than the brothers. Now, Rav Korman brings a Gemara from Bava Basra that describes five sins that Esav had committed that very day, the day of the sale, which Rav Korman uses to frame why Yaakov acts the way that he does. So, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Chamesh Averos Avar Oso Rashab Oso Ayom, there were five Averos that he committed that day. Baal Nara Marusa, he had relations with an engaged woman, which it sounds, I had assumed this was, he raped her. Baharagas and Nefesh, that he murdered somebody. Bechafer Be'ikr, he denied the existence of God. Bechafer B'tchias HaMesim, he denied the concept of resurrection of the dead. Vashat is a Bechorah, and despised his birthright. And the Gemara goes on to explain where it's deriving each of these from. But in Source 7, you can see what Rav Korman sees from this Gemara. Hu echlit al azer lenasos larchiko mimeno. So at that moment, Yaakov, it's like in a flash of inspiration, decides what needs to be done. He needs to distance Esav from Leah as much as possible. So he says to him, Michra kayom es bechorascha, sell me today, right here, right now, your bechorah, but not in the sense of any rights or an inheritance or a grave plot. What does it mean? Habachora, literally in the feminine sense, the firstborn daughter of Lavan, Leah. Sell me your marriage rights to her, the one that's in, that's set to be married to you. Esav lo ratza la'aliv, so Esav doesn't want to embarrass, to insult Leah, the son of his uncle, before Yaakov and the rest of the family. So he tries to explain with a sense of false sincerity why he's so willing to sell this first right, the rights of the firstborn. So he says, Anochi holech lamus, I'm a hunter. I'm going to die at some point. Every moment of my life is surrounded by danger. I could get gored by an animal at any point. Who knows? So why should I take on the responsibility of marriage? And potentially, if I were to die and I'm married, then I'm leaving my wife in a difficult position. So he goes through with the sale. It's great. And then he goes out, he leaves, he stands up and leaves, and it's afterwards that he insults the birthright. And he does it, Rav Korman says, Bifnei Chaboras Ashutvim Lepesha, in front of his kind of posse, his group, of fellow wrongdoers. Again, basing himself on Midrash, that there was a group that Esav was associated with who were engaged in all the iniquity that he himself was engaged with. And Rav Korman assumes that, you know, he explained the real reason to them, that he's not interested in being tied down by marriage. He wants to have his life, his lifestyle. And so what does he care? And so that really reframes the way that we would view Yaakov, at least at face value, in this story. Whereas on the surface, it seems very strange, and even as Esav seems to say later on that he feels as though he's been tricked, it looks a lot like maybe Yaakov is tricking him here. But through Rav Korman's analysis, it's very much not like that at all. Yaakov, in fact, has this moment of inspiration and realizes that he can save Leah, who's innocent, done nothing wrong, and yet is set up to be married to this terrible person. And he found a way out. And not just a way out, but he really takes it upon himself that he's the one who will be marrying her, presumably, which obviously, in fact, that happens. So throughout his piece, the rest of the piece, Rav Korman ties this into several other episodes that happen subsequently between Yaakov and Esav. So just very briefly, when Yaakov splits his camps, he's preparing to meet Esav, and he's assuming that this is not going to be an enjoyable meeting. That it's going to be a fight. And Rav Korman points out a number of interesting facts in this story that are very strange. Just quickly here in the bullet points, Yaakov had four wives, yet is apparently only worried about the safety of one of them. Because at one point here, when he's describing splitting the camps, he's worried that Esav will hit one of the camps, will hit Aim Albanim, will hit a mother and her children. And so obviously the mother is singular and the children is plural, which in turn means that this can't be Rachel that he's referring to because she only had one son at that point. So it must be somebody else. And who is it that perhaps he would be worried about? Leah. Maybe Esav is coming to get Leah, he had been cheated out of. Which also in turn, why does Yaakov emphasize that Esav is his brother? If you're being attacked, what difference does it make? But if Esav is his brother who he had this deal with to buy the marriage rights to Leah, then it makes more sense. And then also when he says a machane achas with Heya Yedia, that it's a specific camp that he's worried about Esav, or that he really kind of essentially knows Esav is going to attack versus just saying in a general sense, a camp. Why is that? Yaakov is certain that he will attack Leah's camp. And it's also strange, too. Why is Yaakov afraid of Esav in this sense? Didn't he have an haftach, a promise from God to be that he would be protected? So Rav Korman feels that protection only applied to Yaakov and his wives, excluding Leah, because fundamentally she really had been set up with Esav, and the fact that he bought the rights to the marriage didn't extend that promise to her. That was Yaakov's fear, at the very least. And later on as well, when Yaakov is concerned about Dinah's safety, it makes sense, because perhaps it's Esav that he's worried about. That Esav not being able to get at Leah will take Dinah as a replacement. And Rav Korman goes on in other places that I put here in Brachos 50:13 and 49:32, especially 49:32 is very significant, where it describes Yaakov. Sorry, let me flip to it. Describes who was buried in Maaret HaMachpelah, and he says, it's 31. Shama kavru es Avram, there they buried Avraham, ves Sara ishto, and they buried Sarah, his wife. Shama kavru es Yitzchak, and they buried Yitzchak, ves Rivka ishto, and Rivka, his wife. Veshama kavarti es Leah. And that's where I buried Leah. So Leah was your wife, Yaakov. Why didn't you also say ishti along with that? Why? Because she already had her right to the grave plot. Esav was the elder of the two sons, and he felt that, you know, there were four couples to be buried there, and he was the last. He and his wife Leah would have been the last couple. So Leah, since she was set up with Esav, had the rights to that her burial plot from the beginning, from birth. So in contrast to Sarah and Rivka, who gained their rights to burial there through marriage to Avram and to Yitzchak. So that's why the pasuk emphasizes ishto and does not say anything like that by Leah. I'll post the piece. It's a very interesting piece. There are certainly bits here and there where one could say that Rav Korman maybe is making some logical jumps that need a little bit more support than he gives them. But we'll just leave whether or not this piece is compelling to the eye of the beholder. Regardless, I think it's a fascinating suggestion. Thank you.